Comment ça va? Coming to you from Skybird Studios in Northumberland, New Hampshire, a land where summer is on a Tuesday. I'm DJ Frederick, or you can call me North Country Fred, and this is the Radio Thrift Shop. We play the dustiest of grooves. There's no agenda, no genre, just music that I enjoy sharing with you. It's all about the joys of musical discovery. I'm celebrating 50 years as a DJ, so thanks for listening and welcome to the Thrift Shop. Welcome to the Radio Thrift Shop on Dolphin Radio, WXDR 99.1 in New Orleans. I'm going to start off this evening's program with one of those great LPs released on the Project 3 Total Sound label, produced by Enoch Light. This is the Guitar Underground with seven great guitars with the Now Sound. We'll be right back. Yeah, two tunes from 1966 from the album Seven Great Guitars with the Now Sound by Guitar Underground. We heard It's Not Unusual and Don't Sleep in the Subway. Good advice. Well, I am DJ Frederick, and this is the Radio Thrift Shop. It's like having a thrift store on the airwaves.
Exploring science in the sea. The sei whale is one of the largest creatures on Earth. Adults can be more than 60 feet long and weigh as much as a fully loaded semi, the third largest of all whales. And they're found across the world in all but the warmest and coldest waters. Yet they're poorly known by the public and scientists alike. The sei whale, spelled S-E-I, gets its name from a Norwegian name for pollock, a cod-like fish. The name was bestowed because the fish and whales showed up at the same time of year. Sei whales have rows of structures made from the same material as teeth and hair, known as baleen. The baleen filters plankton and tiny fish and squid from the water, about 2 tons per day. Much about sei whales remains mysterious. In part, that's because they live mainly in the deep ocean, away from shore. We know they're usually alone or in small groups, and they can race at more than 30 miles an hour for short distances. But much of their life cycle is poorly understood. Whalers killed 250,000 sei before the practice was banned. Recent population estimates range from perhaps 50,000 whales to as many as 80,000. The whales face many threats. They can be hit by ships or entangled in fishing nets. And the warming climate can kill or displace their prey, forcing the whales to change their foraging and breeding grounds. Biologists are trying to find out more about this reclusive giant to better understand how it's adapting to the environment. For the University of Texas Marine Science Institute at Port Aransas, I'm Holly Brawley.
All right, coming up in a few minutes, I'm actually going to start something a little bit different here on Radio Thrift Shop. We're going to be hearing The Wonder of the Age, Mr. Edison's new talking phonograph, an album released on Argo Records in 1970. And it's going to be quite enjoyable and very, very informative. So please stay tuned for that. But before I drop the needle on The Wonder of the Age, Mr. Edison's new talking phonograph, we're going to hear the Jack Marshall Septet from the album 18th Century Jazz, I Didn't Know What Time It Was. And after these recent time changes, daylight savings times, and etc., I really don't know what time it is. Thank you. Jack Marshall from the album 18th Century Jazz, I Didn't Know What Time It Is. You're listening to the Radio Surf Shop with DJ Frederick on Dolphin Radio WXDR 99.1 FM in New Orleans. All right, we're going to hear the entirety of the first two sides of The Wonder of the Age, Mr. Edison's Talking New Phonograph. An album released on Argo Records back in 1970, all about, you guessed it, the talking phonograph. Don't let anyone tell you that the Radio Surf Shop isn't an educational and entertaining broadcast, if I do say so myself.
New York, March the 30th, 1878. Mr. Thomas A. Edison, the celebrated electrician, has invented a talking phonograph, which speaks with great clearness and loud enough to be audible at a distance of 175 feet. The instrument is still in its infancy, but bids fair to become a rival of the telephone, particularly as it is self-recording.
Neither of them knew your tale about the time away. He said, have a dance, my dear, keep quiet, you silly elf. If you play the piano, I can't dance all by myself. At last she drew her husband to her side, and pointing to the gramophone, he cried, put that gramophone record on again. I want to dance to that jazz refrain. Round the room we'll unzip the door, dance out through the door, and back again once more. I'm never found when I hear that sound. Put another needle on and turn the head around. Break the record, break it, melody. Break the record, it will open your face. My delight every night is to listen to the
No matter how familiar a person may be with modern machinery and its wonderful performances, or how clear in his mind the principle underlying this strange device may be, it is impossible to listen to the mechanical speech without his experiencing the idea that his senses are deceiving him. Here is a little affair of a few pieces of metal set up roughly on an iron stand about a foot square that talks in such a way that even if in its present imperfect form many words are not clearly distinguishable, there can be no doubt but that the inflections are those of nothing else than the human voice.
Mr. Edison's workshop is situated at Menlo Park on the line of the New York and Philadelphia Railroad in New Jersey. The building is a long wooden structure facing to the east. A dozen telegraph wires are laid into it by sentry-like poles connecting with the main line along the railroad. The front doors open directly into the office. The second story is one room in which Mr. Edison carries on his experiments. It is an immense laboratory filled with electrical instruments. 1,000 jars of chemicals arranged along the walls. An open rack filled with jars of vitriol stands in the middle of the room. The western end of the apartment is occupied by telephones and other instruments, and there is a small organ in the southwestern corner. Mr. Edison explains very clearly the method of manipulating the phonograph.
The mouthpiece is simply an artificial diaphragm. Turn it over, and you see this thin disc of metal at the bottom. Whenever you speak in the mouthpiece, the vibrations of your voice jar this disc, which, as you see, has in its center a fine steel point. Now for the other part of the machine. Here is a brass cylinder, grooved, something like the spiral part of a screw, only much finer. I wrap a sheet of tin foil around the cylinder and shove the mouthpiece up to it so that the tiny steel point touches the tin foil above one of the grooves. I then turn the cylinder with a crank and talk into the mouthpiece. The vibrations arouse the disc, and the steel point pricks the tin foil, leaving perforations resembling the old Morse telegraphic alphabet. They are really stereoscopic views of the voice, recording all that is said with tone and intonation. It's a matrix of the words and voice, and can be used until worn out.
Mr. Edison blew in at intervals, and the matrix recorded the sound and returned it. He whistled an air from the Grand Duchess, and back it came, as clear as a fife, and in perfect time. He rang a small bell in the funnel. The vibrations were recorded, and on resting the cylinder, the tintinnabulatory sounds poured out soft and mellow. Mr. Edison coughed, sneezed, and laughed at the mouthpiece, and the matrix returned the noises as true as a die.
It has been said that science is never sensational, that it is intellectual, not emotional. But certainly, nothing that can be conceived would be more likely to create the profoundest of sensations, to arouse the liveliest of human emotions, than once more to hear the familiar voices of the dead. Yet science now announces that this is possible and can be done, that the voices of those who departed before the invention of the wonderful apparatus are forever stilled is too obvious a truth. But whoever has spoken, or whoever may speak, into the mouthpiece of the phonograph, and whose words are recorded by it, has the assurance that his speech may be reproduced audibly in his own tones long after he himself has turned to dust. The possibility is simply startling. A strip of indented paper travels through a little machine. The sounds of the latter are magnified, and our great-grandchildren or posterity centuries hence hear us as plainly as if we were present. Speech has become, as it were, immortal.
As Florence Nightingale's house, London, July the 30th, 1890. When I am no longer even a memory, just a name, I hope my voice may perpetuate the great work of my life. God bless my dear old comrades of Balaclava, and bring them safe to shore. Florence Nightingale.
The request that you have done me the honor to make to receive the record of my voice is one that I cheerfully comply with, so far as it lies in my power. Nor I lament to say that the voice I transmit to you is only the relic of an organ the employment of which has been overstrained. Yet I offer you as much as I possess, and so much as all age has left me, with the utmost satisfaction as being at least a testimony to the instruction and delight I have received from your marvelous invention, William U.S. Gladstone.
The best use that I can make of this wonder of the age, the phonograph, is to bid you, on behalf of the citizens of the Dominion of Canada, the most hearty welcome, and to assure you that we are at all times most happy to meet our friends from the United States in the pursuit of science and art and all that may embellish the human life. We bid you a very hearty welcome.
I wish to give my parting thanks to the British public and to assure them that I shall ever gratefully cherish most pleasant memories of their kindness and hospitality, even higher than the pecuniary success with which they have crowned my efforts to please them. I thus address the world through the medium of the latest wonderful invention, Edison's phonograph, so that my voice, like my great show, will reach future generations and be heard centuries after I have joined the great and, as I believe, happy majority, C.D. Bonham. I am Trumpeter Lanfrid, one of the surviving trumpeters in charge of the Light Brigade at Balaclava. I am now going to sound the bugle that was sounded at Waterloo and sound the charge as was sounded at Balaclava on that very same bugle. The 25th of October, 1854.
Record made at Eddington House, Northumberland Avenue, London, August the 2nd, 1890.
What will you do in the long, cold, dark, shivery evenings when your health and convenience compel you to stay indoors? Why, have a phonograph, of course. It is the finest entertainer in the world. There is nothing to equal it in the whole realm of art. It imitates any and every musical instrument, any and every natural sound, faithfully. The human voice, the noise of the cataract, the boom of the gun, the voices of birds or animals. The greatest mimic, a valuable teacher of acoustics, most interesting to old or young, a pleasure and charm to the suffering, bringing them the brightness and amusements of the outside world by its faithful reproductions of operas, new songs, speeches, etc. Every home will sooner or later have its phonograph as a necessity. Have yours now. You will enjoy it longer.
Mr. Edison says the machine is designed for practical use by businessmen and lawyers, etc. Thus, a man may dictate half a dozen letters before leaving his office, and his clerks may write them out in his absence. If he should wish to say more, he can remove the first plate and put in a second, and so on up to any number he may require.
Signor Foghorni, the great Hibernian basso tenore robusto profundo, is so disgusted at the frivolity of contemporary musical taste, which is not ripe enough to appreciate him, that he gives up all attempts to please the present generation. He buys a phonograph instead and devotes his energies to singing for posterity. By applying his ear to this marvelous instrument immediately after singing into it, he not only hears his song echoed back to him out of the dim future, but he also hears the rapturous applause of unborn millions.
Little Menlo, October the 5th, 1888.
Now listen to the voice of Sir Arthur Sullivan.
For myself, I can only say that I am astonished and somewhat terrified at the result of this evening's experiment. Astonished at the wonderful power you have developed, purified at the thought that so much hideous and sad music may be put on record forever. Arthur Sullivan.
As I was a-climb down the road, I met Mr. Topper and I met Miss Toad. Every time Mr. Topper would sing, see that old toad cut the pigeon wing. I lose, way down yonder when I tuck, I lose. I sit in the battle with the kangaroo. I sit in the fort till the head drag ground. I hike it up my feet, then I take another round. Turkey in the sun, a turkey in the hay. I twist and I turn about a high turn of fall. I hook him up a tune called Turkey in the Straw. A turkey in the mud, New York turkey. I twist and I turn about a high turn of fall. I hook him up a tune called Turkey in the Straw.
It was Billy Golden who asked me one day in Washington in 1891 if I would go with him to see a funny German who had started experimenting with a flat disc talking machine record and wanted to make some trials. I was only too eager to see him at work. We found Emil Berliner in his small laboratory on New York Avenue and received a warm welcome from the inventor. Billy was right. Berliner certainly did make me smile. Dressed in a monkish frock, he paced up and down the small studio, buzzing on a diaphragm.
"Hello, hello,"
he recited in guttural broken English.
"Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are."
Berliner delighted in creating effects, and the youthful enthusiasm I showed must have gratified him. I was introduced to the inventor and invited to witness the making of the first gramophone record. Berliner placed a muzzle over Golden's mouth and connected this up by a rubber hose to a diaphragm. I was at the piano, the soundboard of which was also boxed up, and connected to the diaphragm by a hose resembling an elephant's trunk. Berliner said,
"Are you ready?"
And upon our answering yes, he began to crank like a barrel organ and said,
"Go!"
The song finished, Berliner stopped cranking. He took from the machine a bright zinc disc and plunged it into an acid bath for a few minutes. Then, taking it out of the acid, he washed and cleaned the disc. Placing it on a reproducing machine, also operated by hand like a coffee grinder, he played back the resulting record from the etched groove. To our astonished ears came Billy Golden's voice. Berliner proudly explained to us just how his method was superior to the phonograph. He said that in his process the recording stylus was vibrated laterally on a flat surface, thus always encountering an even resistance and thus accounting for the more natural tone.
Mr. Edison has succeeded in improving the phonograph so that it can be worked by a water motor as well as by electricity. An important meeting was recently reported in Chicago by the use of two phonographs. The reporter stood a few yards from the speakers and repeated their speeches into one of the machines until the cylinder was covered by the mystic indentations. Then the operator turned to the other machine and talked into that, while the first cylinder was removed and placed in the hands of the typewriter. The experiment was so successful that a phonographic reporting company has been formed which advertises its ability to report law trials, conventions, and meetings at much cheaper rates and with greater accuracy than under the old system.
New York World, 5th of February, 1890. Berlin. Edison's phonograph and Berliner's gramophone were put in competition today. Berliner, who is an American citizen, was declared the victor. Siemens, the electrician, and a crowd of distinguished people attended. Neither instrument embodies any electrical principle, both being purely mechanical contrivances, but both of the inventors are well known in electrical circles.
It seemed to all concerned as if the gramophone, with its flat disc duplicate records, was now ready for commercial exploitation. The Berliner Gramophone Company of Philadelphia, in fact, began to manufacture small hand-driven machines and asked Berliner to make in Washington an assortment of records comprising a sufficiently varied repertoire to satisfy a small popular demand. A hard rubber concern, which had undertaken to press as many records as might be demanded from the matrices finished by Berliner, found that it could not produce records of even quality. There were flat places here and there caused by gases developed in the rubber when heated, which rendered the whole output unreliable. At this critical stage, Berliner recalled the unsuccessful attempt in 1879 of the Bell Company to utilize an imitation rubber composition for a cheaper hand telephone. Berliner now approached a manufacturer of imitation hard rubber and furnished him with a gramophone matrix. Within a week, the manufacturer supplied a dozen perfect disc records. Thus, for the first time in the history of talking machines, was solved the problem of making unlimited copies of the one original record.
I've many times been asked how to make disc records, and the only reply I can make is that it's not only a trade secret, but that it needs costly and highly elaborate machinery. I had a conversation recently with one of the heads of a big disc factory. We were passing the record-making room at the time, easily distinguishable by the concert then proceeding. I was eager to know all about making these flat records, but my conductor declined to be drawn. I may say, however, that the groove is traced by a stylus vibrating sinuously, that is, sideways instead of up and down as on a cylinder machine. A special machine is also required for recording, and even after the record is made, it must be electroplated and so forth. So you'll see that disc record making is quite out of reach of the ordinary user.
I'm a great phonograph enthusiast and have had some funny experiences since I started selling them. One old lady said she couldn't live in an house where there was one, as it was unnatural and must be an evil spirit or the devil talking, as rats couldn't speak. Now if she wants anything from my shop, she sends for it. I think my dog must have had the same idea, for the first time he heard it, he jumped around and yelped like mad, and eventually pushed his head into the horn to the great danger of the machine, and had to be ejected by force.
When the phonograph comes into general use in this country, a new law will be wanted. We cannot find in any work on the criminal code a punishment for the forgery of voices. There are some excellent mimics who might do great mischief by imitating one's voice in the phonograph.
When the Greenhill mechanical clockwork phonograph motor is ready for sale, few persons who have machines will be troubled by electricity. It'll be absurd to attempt to force a troublesome method of driving power upon the public. It has been left to an Englishman to make the phonograph a commercial success, and we heartily congratulate Mr. Greenhill on his achievement. No more troublesome batteries, no more messes with acids, and no more burnt clothing.
I have succeeded in determining, by the aid of the phonograph, the different emotions of cats, and can tell fairly accurately which is a cry of fear, of delight, of contempt, of amusement, of affection, etc. I can also tell the peculiar cry which a cat makes when he or she wishes to attract the attention of a friend, and also the sound of warning on the approach of an enemy.
Thank you.
diaphragm wasn't very sensitive, and we still required robust, even voices to make good records. Fat, jolly Bert Shepherd, with his powerful tenor voice and clear diction, gave us our most successful results. We used him under many names, and as an old minstrel man, he was very versatile. His repertoire comprised Negro airs, Irish and English ballads, comic and patter songs, parodies and yodels. The spontaneous and boisterous laugh he could conjure up was most infectious and was heard by thousands through his records.
Magnificent! Oh, he's a lovely player. Oh, lovely, lovely. Oh, is that not classical? Isn't it divine? Isn't that the very soul of harmony? How much am I offered for this piano?
10 shillings.
10 shillings? 10 shillings I'm offered for this piano? For this piano, a grand upright piano. And I've only offered 10 shillings. Well, I am astonished. Professor, play us up something more. Play us something from grand opera. Ah, lovely. Beautiful. Oh, isn't that lovely? Isn't it divine? And I'm only offered 10 shillings for this piano. Why, this is the very piano on which Richard Wagner got his first inspiration to write Götterdämmerung. I don't know what it is, but anyway, he wrote it in his piano. And I'm offered 10 shillings. Oh, shades of Beethoven, Haydn, and Wagner, and everybody else look down. I can see that you're not a musically inclined crowd, and I cannot sell you this piano. I'll try you something else. Say, Johnny, hand me down that oil stove and that frying pan.
All right, boss.
The stumbling block which hindered the rapid development of the phonograph was the difficulty of duplicating record cylinders. Inventors of heroic genius made heroic efforts to match up the phonographic cylinder to the gramophone disc. But they could never get round the two basic advantages of the latter. Simple stamping of endless copies from one master and the soundtrack in the disc to guide the reproducing tone arm.
One sultry morning in September 1900, I walked to Hatton Garden, and amongst its shabby offices found a door with this nameplate: The Musiphone Company, Recording Room. Nowadays it would have been called a studio. Then the recording companies hadn't achieved the dignity of this designation. Knocking on the door and receiving no reply, I turned the handle and walked into the office, which was also the recording room. Here I was met by a verbose and blustering individual who demanded my business. This having been satisfactorily explained, the loquacious one introduced himself as Dan Smoot. He was an American, and said he was not in London for his health, but to make cylinder records, and it was time to get going. I now had had time to take in my surroundings, and I was dismayed. Most of the space of the room, the scene of my day's work, was occupied by an improvised rostrum 5 feet in height, upon which an upright grand piano had been hoisted, to enable its soundboard to be on a level with the recording horn. The back and front of the piano had been removed, so that the maximum of sound could be obtained, thus leaving only the action and soundboard. There was no music stand, the music being held up by hand by anybody who had nothing else to do at the time. I had to climb 4 high wooden steps to reach the piano, which brought my head to within a few inches of the ceiling. The singer, an arm resting on the piano, stood in front of a recording horn which measured 5 inches in diameter in such a position that I couldn't see him. In this fantastic setting, and throughout the sultry heat of the day, A.H.G. and Montague Borwell, baritone and tenor, alternated in singing Come Into the Garden, Maud, The Diver, and The Soldiers of the Queen. Precariously perched on a stool on the rostrum, coat discarded, perspiring profusely, I hammered out the accompaniments. Dan Smoot had demanded of me to make the tone double forte, and double forte it was. From time to time the singers whispered appeals to keep it down. If, appalled myself at the din I was making, I did so, Dan Smoot would clamber up the rostrum with the agility of a monkey and fiercely command, "Take no notice! Keep it loud! You're doing fine!" I couldn't judge. My brain, usually cool, detached, and critical of what my hands were doing, was in a state of bewilderment, and I rattled off the accompaniments like an automaton. At the end of the day, I was paid 15 shillings for my 6 hours' work. I was asked to come again the next day, so the presumption was that I had given satisfaction. Such was my introduction to the recording studios.
Song has been pounding out social change since 1949. You're on the Soundbeat.
I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning, I'd hammer out love between all of my brothers all over this land.
Intended to give voice to union workers during the Progressive Era, the song was written by Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes in 1949. The Hammer Song was the breakout hit for their group, The Weavers, and released on their label, Hootenanny Records, in March of 1950. The song paved the way for their commercial success, leading to hits Kisses Sweeter Than Wine and Weem Away. The song's original intent spoke well to the civil rights movement and also helped to kickstart another group's career. Peter, Paul, and Mary's 1962 version was their first big hit. Their next was Puff the Magic Dragon.
All over this land.
This episode was co-written by Kelsey Francella, part of the Soundbeat Class Partnership. Find out more right now at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Libraries. I'm Brett Barry.
And welcome back to the Radio Thrift Shop. I'm DJ Frederick, here with you every Saturday evening at 10 p.m. Be adventurous and browse the thrift shop. If you'd like to correspond, my email address is radiothriftshopnh@gmail.com. That's radiothriftshopnh@gmail.com. Here's Electric Woods.
Thank you.
Band Color Filter with a cover of Donovan's Hurdy Gurdy Man, and before that, a cover of The Zombies' Time of the Season by Electric Woods. All right, I'm DJ Frederick. This is the Radio Thrift Shop, and we're cruising up and down the dusty aisles of music from the past century of recorded sound. I want to say hello and thank you for listening, and wishing you many blessings. And you'll hear me next week here on Dolphin Radio.